Imagine a world where written language flows without spaces, periods, or any other marks to guide your reading. This isn't some dystopian future. It's how English was originally written. David Crystal's Making a Point takes us on a fascinating journey through the evolution of punctuation from its absence in early English to today's complex system. The book has garnered praise from linguists and educators alike, with Stephen Fry calling it enlightening and entertaining in equal measure. Since its 2015 publication, it has become required reading in university linguistics departments worldwide. What makes this exploration so compelling is Crystal's unique ability to balance scholarly rigor with accessibility. He's not prescribing rules, but rather revealing the fascinating story behind the dots, dashes, and squiggles we take for granted. In a world increasingly dominated by digital communication, where punctuation conventions are rapidly evolving, Crystal's insights have never been more relevant or timely. The Alfred Jewell in Oxford's Ashmolean Museum offers a remarkable glimpse into early English writing. This beautiful 9th-century artifact bears an inscription without any punctuation or spaces between words. Alfred mechke wirkan. Alfred ordered me to be made. Similarly, the Frank's casket shows runic inscriptions with no word divisions. These artifacts reveal that what we consider the most fundamental punctuation feature, the word space, was entirely absent in early English writing. This absence makes perfect sense when we consider that reading was primarily an oral activity in ancient times. St. Augustine was so surprised to find his mentor, St. Ambrose, reading silently that he specifically mentioned it in his Confessions, puzzling over why Ambrose would read with his eyes scanning the page and his heart exploring the meaning, but his voice silent and his tongue still. Silent reading was the exception, not the rule. As Christianity spread through England in the 7th century, manuscripts began consistently using word spacing, reflecting a shift towards silent reading practices. Scribes developed sophisticated spacing techniques, often grouping little words with content words, or using variable space widths to indicate meaning relationships. This evolution coincided with St. Augustine's influential views on punctuation's role in preventing theological misinterpretation. Augustine established two principles that would guide punctuation for the next 1600 years. First, let knowledge of the world, Christian faith, influence punctuation placement. Second, examine context carefully. When ambiguity remained despite these approaches, he concluded, "There is nothing to hinder us to point the sentence according to any method we choose." This personal decision-making became a recurring theme throughout punctuation's history. Early manuscripts offered minimal guidance beyond word spaces, though they did mark major divisions with decorated letters, indentation, or outdenting. The ivy leaf, hetera, might mark commentary, while a special dipple, greater than, indicated quotations. Otherwise, text remained largely unpunctuated, making reading as much the reader's job as the writer's. When faced with ambiguous text, readers would add their own marks, just as we do today when preparing speeches or highlighting important passages. Reading aloud in church liturgy made punctuation not just helpful, but essential to religious practice. For monastery communities and congregations who couldn't read, which constituted the vast majority of medieval society, hearing scripture read aloud was their sole gateway to biblical teachings. Saint Benedict's rule emphasized the critical importance of flawless reading, warning that mistakes during public readings required immediate public humiliation, including prostration before the congregation. The 8th century scholar Alcuin, advisor to Charlemagne, meticulously instructed scribes to use relevant marks of punctuation in their proper order to prevent readers from making errors or falling silent before the congregation, a moment considered deeply embarrassing and potentially sacrilegious. Effective oral delivery demanded far more than simply knowing where to breathe. It required emotional conviction and appropriate rhythm to aid both memory and understanding. Readers needed to convey complex theological concepts through careful modulation of voice and timing. From the late 8th century, a more systematic approach emerged using positure, positions, which revolutionized how texts were marked for reading. The punctus versus, resembling a modern semicolon, marked the end of a complete statement with a falling intonation and longer pause. The punctus elevatus, like an inverted semicolon, indicated where the first part of a sentence ended, but the whole thought continued, typically read with a rising intonation to signal incompleteness. This distinction mirrors how we naturally read sentences today, with rising tones at clause breaks and falling tones at sentence endings, a pattern that appears to be nearly universal across languages. The third positura represented a true breakthrough, the question mark, which helped readers modulate their voices appropriately for interrogative statements. During the Middle English period, a fourth mark appeared, the punctus admirativus, or exclamativus, the ancestor of our modern exclamation mark, used to convey strong emotion or emphasis in religious texts. As manuscript production gradually moved beyond monastery walls into the hands of notaries, clerks, commercial scribes, and creative writers, punctuation became increasingly diverse and sophisticated. New paragraph marks emerged, including the pilcro, which helped organize text into digestible sections. Other innovations included parentheses for asides, forward slashes for brief pauses, and eventually the semicolon for complex sentence structures. These developments reflected the growing complexity of written expression and the need for more nuanced ways to guide readers. This transformative period witnessed the emergence of two competing approaches to punctuation that continue to influence practice today: the phonetic approach, marking pauses and rhythms for speech, versus the grammatical approach, marking syntactic structures and logical relationships. This fundamental tension between speaking and writing, between breath and logic, would shape debates about punctuation for centuries to come and remains relevant in contemporary discussions about writing style and readability. Early printers faced enormous challenges standardizing the wildly inconsistent punctuation found in medieval manuscripts. William Caxton, who printed the first book in English around 1473, inherited typefaces and punctuation marks already developed by earlier European printers. However, his actual usage remained sporadic and inconsistent. Comparing modern editions of Caxton's work with the originals reveals dramatic differences. While modern editions apply consistent punctuation rules, Caxton's original texts show remarkable variation. His famous anecdote about egges versus iron demonstrates this inconsistency. He used periods and forward slashes interchangeably, with unpredictable spacing around them. Sentences sometimes began with capitals and sometimes didn't. Sentence endings weren't consistently marked, and paragraph divisions were absent. The 16th century reveals an even messier punctuation landscape. Writers struggled to impose order, with most agreeing that marks reflected 3 degrees of pause: comma, shortest, colon, twice as much, and period, full pause. This mechanical formula, 1 period = 2 colons = 4 commas, was advocated until the 19th century, but produced artificial rhythms when followed strictly. The fundamental tension emerged between phonetic function, guiding pronunciation, and semantic function, clarifying meaning. Shakespeare's First Folio demonstrates this messiness, with different compositors showing preferences for different marks. Printers sometimes made errors or improvised when running out of type, such as creating makeshift question marks when printing dialogue-heavy plays like Hamlet. New punctuation marks like exclamation marks, called the Wanderer, gained popularity in the 1590s, though usage remained inconsistent. Ultimately, printers gained authority over punctuation as authors, uncertain of proper usage, deferred to printing house conventions. 17th and 18th century printers faced opposing author types: meticulous Johnsonians, who insisted on checking every mark, and Wordsworthians, who cared nothing for punctuation. Wordsworth himself admitted being no adept at punctuation, even asking the chemist Humphrey Davy to correct his work. Dryden exemplified the opposite approach, complaining that printers were beasts who understood nothing about corrections and threatening eternal displeasure if his amendments weren't followed exactly. By the late 16th century, punctuation had found its place within grammar. Ben Jonson's English Grammar represents this shift, describing punctuation marks as breathing pauses. Jonson was meticulous about punctuation, famously quarreling with printers who failed to follow his preferences. In Timber, or Discoveries, he noted how writers fought, as for their fires and their altars, over ceremonies, syllables, points, colons, commas, hyphens, and the like. The 17th century saw many pedagogical guides to punctuation, but with no agreement on approach. The debate continued. Was punctuation for pronunciation or for reading, for rhetoric or grammar? As grammar teaching became routine, the grammatical approach prevailed, offering system where previously there had been variation. Bishop Loth's influential A Short Introduction to English Grammar, 1762, acknowledged punctuation's limitations, noting that few precise rules can be given which will hold without exception, and much must be left to the judgment and taste of the writer. Joseph Robertson's An Essay on Punctuation, 1785, defined punctuation purely grammatically as the art of dividing a discourse into periods, listing 40 rules for comma usage alone, yet admitted these rules couldn't cover every imaginable combination of words. Lindley Murray's immensely popular English Grammar, 1795, sold over 20 million copies and treated punctuation as a special topic that could not have been exclusively discussed under the part of syntax or of prosody. While maintaining the traditional pause length equation, Murray acknowledged that judgment was ultimately required. Thomas Sheridan, a popular elocutionist, criticized the grammatical approach to punctuation as erroneous and inaccurate, noting that commas often appeared where speech required no pause, and pauses were needed where no punctuation appeared. He blamed grammarians for developing a model not taken from the art of speaking, and teachers for teaching false rules. Despite these criticisms, the grammatical approach prevailed, resulting in increasingly heavy punctuation throughout the 18th century. By the 19th century, printers like George Smallfield became more explicit, defining punctuation as the art of dividing a written or printed composition into sentences, using points to mark pauses required by sense and pronunciation. Though Smallfield followed Murray's grammatical approach, he acknowledged disagreements among grammarians, particularly regarding comma usage. Punctuation functions as a hierarchical system where some marks carry greater importance than others, either by marking major pauses or significant grammatical breaks. Modern teaching approaches recognize this hierarchy, typically beginning with the most fundamental mark, the period or full stop. However, early punctuation writers consistently began with commas rather than periods, moving from shortest to longest pauses, which gave readers a distorted understanding of the system's structure. The blank page represents the true starting point of the punctuation hierarchy, a fact recognized by ancient manuscript writers but often taken for granted in the age of print. When writing or reading, our first decisions involve placement and organization on the page. At the highest level are the semantic organizational elements, like titles, headings, footnotes, and body text, which convey the writer's opinion about each element's importance. Our next layout decisions involve whether to present text as a single block or divide it into sections and paragraphs. Traditional English teaching emphasized paragraph unity and the need for a controlling topic sentence, typically recommending 3 to 6 sentences per paragraph. However, modern writing has shown single-sentence paragraphs can be rhetorically effective, while overly long paragraphs spanning entire pages hinder comprehension. At the sentence level, the period marks the end of a unit of sense, but it's not the only way to end such units. There are actually 6 main options for ending a statement: period, question mark, exclamation point, dash, ellipsis, or nothing at all. Each conveys different semantic functions. Period, the neutral default for simple statements of fact. Question mark, adds questioning tone, genuine inquiry, abrupt instruction, uncertain suggestion. Exclamation point, adds exclamatory tone, command, disbelief. Dash adds abrupt tone with various semantic implications. Ellipsis adds ambiguous tone with multiple possible interpretations. No punctuation leaves interpretation open. Within sentences, commas operate at multiple grammatical levels, separating not just clauses but phrases and words as well. Their presence or absence isn't merely stylistic, but often determines meaning. With relative clauses, commas create crucial semantic distinctions. My sister, who lives in China, has sent me a letter, indicating one sister, versus my sister who lives in China has sent me a letter, indicating multiple sisters. Semicolons have earned a controversial reputation, particularly among novelists who associate them with formal writing rather than natural dialogue. Kurt Vonnegut famously dismissed them as transvestite hermaphrodites representing absolutely nothing that merely signal academic pretension. Yet he deliberately used one in his final chapter, concluding that rules only take us so far, even good rules. The semicolon's unique value lies in its ability to express a relationship between independent sentences that periods cannot convey. While Smith is going to speak about cars, Brown is going to speak about bikes, presents these as separate events. Smith is going to speak about cars, Brown is going to speak about bikes, suggests they're connected within a larger context. The semicolon functions as punctuation's equivalent to the coordinating conjunction and, simultaneously uniting and dividing. Despite its utility, semicolon usage has steadily declined throughout the 20th century, now comprising only about 2% of all punctuation marks versus 90% for periods and commas. The mark peaked in the 18th century when long, elegant sentences were fashionable. Apostrophe misuse can have serious consequences, as demonstrated when Jeff Deck and Benjamin Herson of the Typo Eradication Advancement League corrected a historical sign at the Grand Canyon, resulting in federal charges and fines of $3,500. While America has TEAL, Britain has the more moderate Apostrophe Protection Society, founded in 2001 to preserve correct apostrophe usage. The apostrophe arrived late to English punctuation in the late 16th century, which partly explains the confusion surrounding its use. English managed without apostrophes for nearly a millennium, expressing possession through inflectional endings like es, Skypes equals ships, which eventually simplified to s before apostrophes existed. During the 17th century, a consensus began to emerge about apostrophe usage, particularly to distinguish between singular and plural possessives. By the 18th century, grammarians recognized the two conventions, s and s apostrophe, but doubts remained. Spelling reformers like George Bernard Shaw avoided apostrophes whenever possible, considering them ugly bacilli. Hyphen usage remains equally chaotic despite serving two main functions, as a divider showing word breaks at line ends and as a linker marking unity between distinct grammatical elements. The more complex issue involves compound words, which can be written spaced, flower pot, hyphenated, flower dash pot, or solid, flower pot. Practices vary between publishers, countries, and over time, with British publishers generally favoring hyphens more than American ones. Contrary to early myths about the internet eliminating punctuation, we're experiencing both minimalism and maximalism online. The keyboard enables punctuation maximalism, holding down keys to create strings like yes! Exclamation point, or novel sequences like dot dot dot, or question, question, question. These expressive patterns emerge organically from user behavior, creating new conventions for emphasis and emotion. Meanwhile, minimalist trends echo both contemporary writers like Cormac McCarthy and the earliest unpunctuated English texts, with many social media users eschewing traditional punctuation entirely. What makes this situation unprecedented is that for the first time since the Middle Ages, writing appears in public without professional editing oversight. As Constance Hale and Jesse Scanlon observed in Wired Style, online writing represents a clash between copy editors' rule-following and coders' symbol appropriation. This tension has created a fascinating hybrid space where traditional rules meet creative innovation, resulting in new linguistic patterns that would have been unthinkable in previous eras. We now live in a state of digraphia. Standard English punctuation remains dominant offline, while non-standard punctuation flourish in certain online genres. This digital-analog divide manifests in everything from professional emails to casual messaging apps, each with its own implicit rules and expectations. The challenge for users is not mixing these worlds, and for teachers, helping students recognize these stylistic differences and navigate them appropriately in different contexts. Internet usage has developed specialized punctuation conventions, underscores for emphasis, like this, angle brackets for commentary, and capitals for shouting. The at symbol functions on the edge of the punctuation system, both linking and separating elements in an address. Platform-specific conventions have also emerged, such as hashtags for categorization and topic marking, asterisks for corrections or emphasis, and tildes for decorative or playful purposes. Emoticons represent another punctuation innovation, combining marks with letters and numerals to replicate facial expressions. They function both as semantic entities replacing whole utterances and as period with presence at sentence ends, clarifying tone or intention. Despite initial excitement, studies show emoticons appear in only 10 to 20% of online interactions, with just a handful of basic ones used routinely: smiley, frowning, nodding, or surprise. Their evolution into emojis has further expanded the repertoire of digital expression, though traditional emoticons persist in certain contexts. Perhaps most fascinating is how digital communication has transformed the semantic weight of traditional punctuation marks. As zero punctuation becomes the neutral default in texting and messaging, the period has acquired new meaning. What was once neutral now conveys seriousness, finality, or even anger. "We could do that" reads as neutral, while "we could do that" signals displeasure. This semantic shift extends to other marks as well. Multiple question marks indicate genuine curiosity or enthusiasm, while a single one can seem curt or passive-aggressive. This semantic shift is predictable given punctuation's systemic nature. Change one value and others shift accordingly, creating a dynamic and evolving system of digital communication markers. The most sensible approach to punctuation is pragmatic rather than dogmatic. Punctuation has always been a matter of trends, subject to changes in fashion between formal and informal writing, British and American usage, print and digital media, publishers, authors, generations, and genders. No one has ever defined rules explaining all uses of all punctuation marks. The best we can do is identify norms, plot trends, emphasize personal consistency, and be cautious about generalizations. Hardly any punctuation rules are followed by everyone all the time. Being pragmatic doesn't mean anything goes. It means respecting linguistic realities, whether rule-based or not, while not imposing unauthentic rules. Teaching unauthentic rules can actually cause illiteracy, as learners encounter variation everywhere and become confused. Despite exceptions and taste variations, punctuation is a system, hierarchical, with fixed choices at each level. Though small compared to grammar, just a dozen common marks, taste affects about half the descriptive observations in this book, while the other half follows rules. Punctuation serves multiple functions beyond pronunciation and grammar: ludic, playful; psycholinguistic, facilitating processing; sociolinguistic, building rapport; and stylistic, creating genre identity. Each written genre has its own orthographic style, from advertisement to liturgy to literature. Even when writers like Joyce or Cummings break rules, they don't use punctuation arbitrarily. Literary writers have long recognized punctuation's power. Jane Austen's manuscripts reveal her distinctive style, featuring abundant dashes, minimal punctuation, and idiosyncratic formatting choices like using double colons for line breaks. Publishers normalized her writing according to prescriptive grammatical standards, replacing her rhetorical dashes with semicolons and commas, adding paragraphing, and removing her capitalization of common nouns. This editorial intervention created the false impression of Austen as a conformant and prim stylistic, rather than the more experimental writer revealed in her manuscripts. Similarly, Emily Dickinson's poetry has suffered editorial interference. Her manuscripts show eccentric longhand featuring capitalized substantive nouns and dashes as all-purpose punctuation. Modern editors often regularize her work, replacing dashes with commas and periods, claiming this makes her poetry more accessible to the eye of the modern reader. Perhaps Gertrude Stein had the most personal relationship with punctuation of any writer, attributing personality to marks and treating them with loving hate. She particularly despised question marks, finding them positively revolting and unnecessary. A question is a question. Anybody can know that a question is a question, and so why add to it the question mark when it is already there when the question is already there in the writing? As digital communication continues to transform punctuation conventions, teaching approaches must evolve as well. Crystal offers several principles for teaching punctuation effectively. 1. Never isolate punctuation. Treat it as part of the entire writing system, orthography, which itself connects to grammar, pronunciation, vocabulary, discourse, and style. 2. Detect the limitations. Punctuation represents speech's dynamic features, intonation, loudness, rhythm, pause, in black and white terms, while speech contains shades of gray. 3. Recognize the hierarchical system. Punctuation marks operate at different grammatical levels: paragraphs, sentences, clauses, phrases, words. 4. Work within genres. Present punctuation choices within a single genre, focusing on motivating examples like computer games, text messages, or popular stories. 5. Highlight consistency. While personal variation in punctuation is inevitable, consistency remains essential. 6. Take account of the child's point of view. Even young children have encountered punctuation and formed opinions about it. 7. Make the task more appealing. Incorporate punctuation into fiction through anthropomorphic stories, games, and creative activities. 8. Become an MP, Master of Punctuation. The ultimate goal is to help students understand the rules while appreciating their limitations. One message resonates throughout punctuation's history. It exists to make written text clear. Whether reading aloud or silently, punctuation helps us make sense of written language. We need both semantic approaches, focusing on clarity, and pragmatic approaches, considering effects and appropriateness, to understand punctuation fully. Successful written communication requires expressing ourselves clearly while presenting language effectively. Our choices may be guided by semantics, clarity, or pragmatics, appearance, space constraints, or convention. Literary writers like Cormac McCarthy often make aesthetic choices, preferring minimal punctuation for an uncluttered page, though such choices have consequences for sentence structure and style. In the end, punctuation is neither a rigid system of rules nor a free-for-all of personal preference. It's a living, evolving set of conventions that balances clarity with expressiveness, tradition with innovation. Understanding its history helps us appreciate its complexity and use it more effectively in our increasingly text-based world.